slip out in the night. I'm watching the sea. She's come halfway around the world to see the light and to stay away from me. There is a shipwreck lying at my feet. Somewhere.
James Taylor's song kind of seems appropriate today to start with that song called Lighthouse as we turn our attention to the lighthouses in our state. You know, ship captains once relied on lighthouses to guide them to safety, and onboard guidance systems have replaced the need for most of those shoreline towers, yet many lighthouses still stand as a reminder of kind of a bygone area here in our state. Larry Mueller here, joined today by two lighthouse historians, Barb and Ken Wardy, as co-authors of the book Wisconsin Lighthouses, a Photographic and Historical Guide. They've written three other lighthouse-specific books, and it's great to have them with us today. And I hope you'll join in with your questions about lighthouses. Do you have a favorite lighthouse in the state? What have your experiences been visiting our lighthouses? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Barb, welcome. Thanks for joining in.
Good morning, Larry. So glad to be here.
And Ken Wardy, as welcome to you. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Larry. Good morning to you and the listeners as well.
Well, you know, for decades, the two of you have been, you've been writing, you've been photographing, you've been giving presentations on lighthouses in our state. What sparked this interest for you?
Oh, gosh, this goes back 30, 40 years. Our first lighthouse trip we took with friends to Kena Island in Door County, and we just thought Kena Island and the lighthouse were beautiful, and we wanted to know more about the people that were there. The buildings were great, but who lived there? What did they do? What was their job? And that's how it all began, very innocently.
What is it? Maybe Ken, you could chime in. What is it about lighthouses that makes so many of them a popular destination for tourists?
They certainly are great subjects, Larry. Barb and I each had an interest in history, specifically maritime history. And as she mentioned, when we visited some of the early lights when this journey first started, it's nice to know it was built in such and such a year. It's so many feet tall. But there are a significant number of keepers and families that spent decades attending these lights, and it was really the people aspect of the lights that really moved us forward in our journey to learn more about them as well.
You are both among the experts featured in a new PBS Wisconsin documentary. It's titled Wisconsin Lighthouses, and it premieres tonight at 7. I had a chance to look at it. How excited were you to see an hour-long documentary about your favorite subject?
Oh, my gosh. We were so honored, first of all, to be asked. But then when you see yourself on TV, it isn't something we normally do. But our producer, Jeff Pfeiffer, made us look good, as the rest of the staff did as well. It was a great experience, so it really was.
What was the involvement in the documentary like? Give us a little more detail on that.
Sure.
Larry, he asked, Jeff Pfeiffer, our producer, asked us some generic questions to start with, but then we gave him a lot of resources that we had, archival photos, photos from lighthouse keepers' families. Have to put a plug in, too. When Barb and I did a lot of the research for all the 48 lights in Wisconsin, we visited public libraries, historical societies, descendants of lighthouse keepers. Without all of their collective help, none of our research would have gone anywhere. So hats off to all of those folks.
You know, I said it was 60 minutes long. I saw a 60-minute version of it, and I loved it. It was really interesting. And good to know that it's the show that people are going to see tonight is actually 90 minutes, and it airs from 7 to 8:30 tonight in our PBS stations. I don't know what's included in that last 30 minutes, but I'm actually now I got to listen. Now I got to watch it again and hear see the rest of it. You know, right away in the beginning, almost in the beginning, there's a historian, another historian says that without lighthouses, Wisconsin doesn't happen. That caused me to pause. Do you agree with that? And why?
Well, absolutely. Can you imagine being out in the great inland seas that is, you know, Lake Michigan? It's dark, it's windy, it's stormy, you're in a wooden schooner. You have no GPS. You don't know where you are. So as the country began to expand, lighthouses were definitely needed just to guide mariners and keep them safe.
And they brought a lot of people to Wisconsin.
Absolutely, Larry. As Barb mentioned, when the country expanded west, the modern highways of that era, if you will, were waterways. Before the modern railroad system was developed that we enjoy today, as well as the highways, things moved primarily by water. Yes, some things did move by land very slowly. The roads were quite primitive by today's standards. So the necessity to have safeguards out on the Great Lakes area, for example, was paramount to be able to move people, to move goods throughout as the country expanded westward.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and we mentioned Lake Michigan a few times, but Wisconsin has a great deal of Lake Superior and Lake Michigan shoreline, of course, and I got to believe those were, how many were there? I forgot, 48, wasn't it?
There's 48.
Depending on how you count lighthouses, and the reason I say that, in some specific areas there are two lights. They're called range lights. Do you count those as one unit? Do you count them as two structures? The book that Barb and I produced, we ended up with 48 different locations. A few of them no longer exist. So sometimes the numbers are a little, it's like the height of a lighthouse, depending on what document you may read. You know, what year was it built? What year was it lit? How tall is it? How high is it above the water? So some of those things, sometimes the numbers can be a little bit different. But we claim 48 structures.
And I think Michigan is the only... the only state with more.
Absolutely. Michigan has more coastline, they have more Great Lakes, and they have almost three times as many lights as the Badger State.
Most of the lighthouses were built, in Wisconsin at least, between 1850 and 1900. And just the construction of those, I mean, those early ones, I mean, there was a lot of work involved in building those structures.
Oh, there sure was. Can you imagine, you know, 100 years ago, 100 plus years ago, they didn't have the technology or the machinery we had today. And they really had engineers that could figure it out. Someplace like that would be on a high bluff, like North Point, Milwaukee. If there were no roads, they were hauling things up the bluff to build those lighthouses. Everything came by water, especially building materials.
Yeah, and the lighthouses themselves, how were they originally operated? What kinds of, they used of what, Fennel lenses, I think?
Fresnel lenses, F-R-E-S-N-E-L. The gentleman that invented them, but that lens, Augustin Jean Fresnel, was a French physicist. Early on, the technology, just like technology today, advances much quicker today than it did back then. But the technology of the lamp, the light, the building materials started off fairly primitive, is not the right word, but very, very simply. As technology advanced, they went from whale oil as a fuel to kerosene as a fuel, eventually acetylene. And not every lighthouse had that progression. Many lighthouses today still do not have electricity. So the forward movement of technology and improvements really over the course of 50, more than 50 plus years, eventually made lighthouses obsolete. They improved things so well there was no need for the structure, and then certainly the keepers and their families.
Yeah. And there were some in the documentary, the PBS documentary people are going to see tonight, there were some shots of those Fresnel lenses, which are, I guess, what were they, polished glass?
Oh, the Fresnel lenses are works of art. You know, they weren't intended to be works of art. They were machinery, of course, but yeah, they're polished glass prisms, and they would have all been manufactured and built in Paris, assembled and tested, and put in this brass beehive framework to hold them together, then disassembled. All the prisms were marked in order so the lampist here in Wisconsin would know how to reassemble this device at the top of the tower. If it was a small lens, they could usually just carry the pieces up through the hatchway. If it was larger, they probably used something like a block and tackle system to haul all of that machinery to the top of the tower.
It's just, they're beautiful to see up close for sure. Well, let's talk first in general about the people who maintain the lighthouses. I want to get into some specifics, but generally speaking, somebody had to be there all the time.
That's right, Larry. Many times, depending on how severe the winter was, some lighthouses would be open year-round. On the Great Lakes, if it was a pretty nasty winter and some of the lakes froze up, the keepers would not have to man the light. But a lot of times the lighthouse era we think of as this just romantic, glorious, idyllic time. It was work upon work upon work. Even if the station was only open, say, early spring till late fall, every single day the lamp was tended to. It was cleaned. There was painting. There was all kinds of other chores. Many times the spouse, of course, at that time, usually the wife, many times had a title of assistant keeper, many times not. The children even had lighthouse chores. So it was almost a 24/7 job when the light was working in season, but a tremendous amount of work. Many times these families were stationed at various lighthouses for several decades.
Yeah, and they also had to, you know, in a lot of cases, grow their own food and, you know, take care of things that way.
They had to be very self-sufficient. Again, there are no roads of any consequence. You had to have everything you needed with you. So many of them would have farm animals, if they had the space. We're told almost all of them had vegetable gardens. Some would have had fruit trees. And, of course, Mom, the lighthouse assistant keeper, would have been doing a lot of canning and a lot of cooking. We're told that most of the lighthouse moms at that time also made all their children's clothes. They just couldn't pop over to Target and get the kids a new outfit. So there was always something going on that they had to take care of for themselves.
And Larry, too, the government did supply various staples, flour, sugar, those kind of everyday things that were necessary. But these folks were very, very, again, hardworking. It was that era, I think, when people, you know, much like today, they take pride in their work. They do their job day in and day out. Many times don't get the accolades or, you know, the congratulations, mm-hmm. but it was so important for mariners out on the Great Lakes to know that they could count on seeing the light when they needed to for their safety.
Yeah. Barb and Ken Wardy is our guest today. They are co-authors of Wisconsin Lighthouses, a photographic and historical guide, and three other books about specific lighthouses in Door County, Racine, and Milwaukee. our guests today. Questions for them or comments or maybe an experience to share if you visited a lighthouse, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk with Mike Bino, editor of Our Wisconsin magazine, about the new issue, the December-January issue. That's at noon today. Right now, we're looking at Wisconsin lighthouses with Barb and Ken Wardius, co-authors of Wisconsin Lighthouse, Wisconsin Lighthouses, a photographic and historical guide, among other books that they've written about lighthouses. Give us a call with your questions. Again, the number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. And just again to mention the PBS Wisconsin documentary entitled Wisconsin Lighthouses premieres tonight at 7 p.m. on our Wisconsin PBS station. So looking forward to that as well. Jay and Two Rivers, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jay.
Morning, gentlemen. After reading the history of the Raleigh Point Lighthouse and the lighthouse keeper, that does seem like an incredibly difficult life, similar to being a farmer or like one of our fishing tug operators out of Two Rivers, just a tough life. But if I remember correctly, I think the Raleigh Point Lighthouse just north of Two Rivers is one of the highest or the highest on Lake Michigan at, I think, 113 feet. And it's, I believe, it's called a skeleton design. There's a central metal tube that the spiral staircase goes up, but it's supported by surrounding metal pipes that support the structure. So we've been on top. It's a spectacular view. You can see over the treetops of Point Beach State Forest, which is a pretty neat place too. So I just thought I'd make that comment and see what you got to say.
Oh, Jay, thank you so much for calling. Comments?
Yes, Jay knows his stuff. He really does. Raleigh Point is 111 feet tall. That we got number, the number that was from the Coast Guard. It is the tallest in Wisconsin. And he's very fortunate to have made it up to the lantern room to climb the tower. Raleigh Point is used as a military morale cottage, so active and retired military can apply for weeks of vacation there. We were fortunate years ago to know a retired Marine that was there for the week and invited us up for the day. So we've actually climbed Raleigh Point one time. That was a very important light. And the original building, if you go to visit, the keeper's quarters is there, and there's something on the one side of the building that looks very much like a lighthouse, and it was the original tower at that location. The mariners were clamoring for a taller tower, so history tells us they chopped the old tower down, re-roofed it, and it became part of the keeper's round living room, and that's when they put the tall skeletal tower into place.
Very, very cool story. Thank you again for that question. Appreciate it very much. And comment. Helen in West Salem will turn to you. Hi, Helen.
Hi. Now, I read this or heard it somewhere, and I don't know if it's Wisconsin or not, but there was a woman that was in the lighthouse who had a baby who never, ever left. She didn't go to the hospital to have the baby. She had the baby. She stayed there all her life. And I'm just wondering, is that true? I don't know where I heard this.
Oh, that's the story of Georgia Stebbins, I bet.
Great great point, Larry. Helen, there's a number, again, think back to that era. Let's just pick, you know, the late 1800s. It is not unusual for ladies to have babies at their residence. There was a keeper in Milwaukee, Georgia Green Stebbins. She gave birth to her son at the North Point Lighthouse. Later on, she had a three-generation family living at the lighthouse. Her son eventually grew up, got married, had his wife, had two grandchildren also born at the lighthouse. So again, that era, you weren't likely to be going, to the nearest hospital. Some people probably did, but it just gives you a look back into that time that those sort of things happened routinely. These folks just, they just did what they needed to do. And certainly giving birth is not quite the same as tending to a light each night, but very, very, very tough people.
It was really, Barb, maybe you can talk a little bit more about what got her there. She came from New York with tuberculosis, I believe, didn't she?
Yes, Georgia came from the East. She came from New York State. We don't know if she traveled alone or if her husband joined her at that time, but she did come to Milwaukee with tuberculosis. And the reason she came to Milwaukee was to help her parents at the original North Point Lighthouse that was built close to the bluff in 1855. Her father's health was not good. So when she arrived, she began immediately learning and doing lighthouse chores and all the duties. And eventually she ended up taking over those duties from both of her parents.
And if I'm not mistaken, her health improved with the better air.
Can you imagine? I think they said her doctors told her, well, go west, go to Wisconsin. The fresh lake breezes will do you good. So apparently they did, or maybe just all that hard work. I'm not sure, but we are so fortunate that she was with us in Milwaukee all those years.
It's a great story, and thank you for that question and comment. I appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Early lighthouse keepers were called Wikis, I believe. Why was that?
Yeah, that's a nickname that stuck for a number of decades, Larry. During the night, once they had the light lit, they would be required to tend the light all night long. Usually every few hours, they would go up to the lamp, check the height of the flame so that they knew they had a good light, a good flame. But the wick material eventually would, every few hours, would need to be trimmed. So they would have some sort of special scissors, and they would trim it to the correct height. So again, there was an expression, keep a good light. And so by trimming the wick, eventually that nickname of Wickies kind of stood for a number of decades.
I like that. That's a good handle to have. I'm a Wiki. Door County, what do we have? 11, I think, lighthouses in Door County, which is more per mile of shoreline than anywhere else in the world. One of them is the Kena Island lighthouses, and one of your books is about the Kena Island lighthouse. Talk some more about the significance of the Kena Island lighthouse.
Kena Island was built in 1869. It was one of three lights that replaced the original light in Bailey's Harbor called the Old Birdcage Style Light, which was not in the best location. So Kena Island is considered a coastal light, a coastal beacon. It has its original third order Fresnel lens still in the tower, and that is going to remain there for historical purposes, which is a wonderful thing. But again, mariners were saying the original light is not working. We can't see it. We can't get into Bailey's Harbor safely. So they had to build three lighthouses to guide them in. And Kena was, I think, the most important of those three.
And that was built, didn't they use Cream City brick from Milwaukee for that?
They sure did, Larry. That was actually a very common building material for some of the earlier lights, not only some of the architecture in the Midwest, but the original Milwaukee North Point light in Lake Park was built of Milwaukee Cream City brick. A number of lights in Door County, Eagle Bluff, in Peninsula State Park, and as well as you mentioned, Kena Island. A very common, very sturdy brick material for construction.
That Eagle Bluff lighthouse, I've been to that many times in Peninsula State Park. That's a really cool lighthouse. And the family, is it Duquesne family?
Yes, the Duquesne family.
Duquesne family, okay.
The Duquesne family, yes.
Well, talk about the lighthouse and talk about the family.
Okay, so this was Captain William Duquesne and his wife Julia, who raised seven boys at the Eagle Bluff Lighthouse. Now, this is a lovely home, Larry. You've been through it, but can you imagine two adults and seven boys coexisting peaceably in this home? But they sure did it. And the youngest son was back at the lighthouse when they were restoring it about 30 years ago. And they had asked him about all the paint on the walls, because when they restored it, there were layers upon layers of paint. And he said, well, whenever we were bad, Mom handed us a paintbrush and said, go paint. So he said, we painted a lot. That explained everything.
And they were a real musical family. I mean, this was, you know, you think about lighthouses being sort of you're alone or, you know, just with your family. But this group, they were all musicians, if I'm not mistaken.
The Duquesne boys all played instruments, and that was due to their mother insisting that they know how to read music and play music. And they even had an orchestra that they would travel around to different events in Door County, perhaps a wedding or a party. So they were certainly busy day and night.
And there was even a little fisticuffs once in a while when the boys were out playing.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, when seven youngsters, boys get together, Larry, there's going to be some shenanigans going on.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it's one of those places. I mean, it was a nice home compared to a lot of the sort of almost shack-like things that other people lived in out in that area. And it did become quite a... I would call it a community center in many ways, because they would entertain a lot.
Yes, the Eagle Bluff is, it's one of the lights in Wisconsin. That's certainly one of our favorites, but the fact that it's been restored to an era when the Duquesne family was there, it gives you a window, if you will, to that era, to the history of that time. Again, simpler times, yes. Very hardworking people, yes. And again, sometimes we think of, you know, that time as just this grand, you know, time of romantic lighthouse tales. There was some of that, certainly. But day in and day out, not only the Duquesne family, but other family members, other lighthouse keepers at various locations did tremendous amounts of work every single day.
Yeah. Michael in Maple Bluff will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. I often visit Plum Island, which is on the ferry route from the main door up to Washington Island. And on the south shore of Plum Island, there is the ruined foundation of a very old lighthouse, which I think was actually originally built by private subscription from merchants and shippers who were worried about passage through the Death Door Passage, maybe in the 1830s. Some archaeologists have excavated that and put up a nice plaque at the site. When I first visited it, they were saying, keep it quiet, we're trying to get this thing done before people come and visit it. But it's just to the right of the range light, just to the east of the range light, the shore side range light on Plum Island. Do your guests know about that ruined lighthouse?
Good morning, Michael. We sure do. We have a photo in our book taken, 20 plus years ago. So I'm so sure there isn't as much left as we have in the picture. But we were very interested to hear about this light being there so early before the Plum Island range lights were put into service. And they said, too, this one was not in the best place, but at the time, it did what it had to do, and mariners did use it until the range lights were built. Plum Island is a wonderful place. Are you familiar with the Friends group, the Friends of Plum and Pilot Island?
Yes, in fact, I've often been tempted to be a member, but I meet those people when I'm on Washington Island. There's a number of them who come even from this Madison area to help out with the maintenance of things on Plum Island.
Michael and Larry, I have to put a plug in for the Friends of Plum and Pilot Island also.
Yeah.
The Death Door Strait, it was an incredibly dangerous and incredibly important water route historically in Door County. So there was certainly a need for lighthouses. And the one that Michael referenced was the first one in that strait. Eventually, three other lights in that area took the place of the original. To the east, just a few miles, is Pilot Island. A separate lighthouse was placed on Pilot Island. And then back on Plum Island, two range lights to give mariners a straight line, safe course through the Death Door Passage was necessary as well. But that entire area, Commerce, Native Americans used it, very treacherous at times, depending on currents and waves and storms. Historically, one of the most important, where Door County gets its name from, incredibly important maritime travel route.
Yeah, and a lot of ships went down in that, and boats went down in that area.
Even with lighthouses, unfortunately, storms on the Great Lakes, there's a little phrase that the lake is the boss, whether you're talking about Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, any of the other Great Lakes. Some of these inland seas, these inland storms can be quite hazardous, and certainly lighthouses prevented additional shipwrecks, but even with them, it gives you an idea of that time frame. All the modern metal super tankers that come and go through the Great Lakes today, wooden schooners had different circumstances.
Absolutely. Michael, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Very much. Our guests today, Barb and Ken Wardius, co-authors of Wisconsin Lighthouses, a photographic and historical guide. And we're talking lighthouses kind of as a intro to you to the PBS Wisconsin documentary that will be playing tonight beginning at 7, titled Wisconsin Lighthouses. Questions for them, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about books for adults and children to give as gifts during the holiday season. We visit with Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, and also joining us after, Tessa Schmidt and Megan Schliesman at the UW-Madison's Cooperative Children's Book Center. That's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. Right now, taking a look at lighthouses in our state, and you can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Jim and Stevens Point called, couldn't stay with us, but wanted to know how far out on the water is the light from a lighthouse visible?
That's an excellent question. A lot of it depends on location. How tall is the light? Not only the structure itself, but is it up on a bluff? Is it down in a harbor? And it also depends, the other main factor, Larry, would be the size of the lens that the lighthouse has. Lighthouse lenses come in order. They're called orders. That means the size. The first order is a humongous 10-foot-tall structure. A sixth order is about a foot and a half tall. And everything in between, bigger or smaller, would dictate how far that beam can go out on the lake. So it depends on the size of the lens, the height of the tower, or how tall the tower is above the lake. The furthest number of miles that a very powerful light with a large lens up on a tall bluff with a tall tower would be somewhere in the range of 20 to 25 miles. That's on a clear night. If the weather is foggy or it's stormy, it would be less than that. Most of the harbor lights would have fourth, fifth, or sixth order lenses, smaller lenses, but they were more necessary for directing ships as they became closer to the various ports, so they would not have needed to be as tall, and the light would not have needed to be as powerful. Many of those lenses could be 5 miles to 10 miles for a good distance on a clear night.
That's still a pretty good distance. Allison in Racine has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Before I ask my questions, I think Mr. and Mrs. Wardius came and spoke at my daughter's school, the Prairie School in Racine. And if I'm correct in my memory, I just wanted to say thank you so much for your work with the children, because you really made the information come to life, especially for my daughter. She just became incredibly enthusiastic and interested in lighthouses. So thank you for... And my questions were, if you had any interesting anecdotes about the Upper and Lower Range lighthouses in Bailey's Harbor or the Wind Point Lighthouse in Racine.
Well, Allison, thanks so much. We enjoyed our time at Prairie School. We've been doing this. We look back, we think at least 7 or 8 years, they asked us to come once a year to talk to the kids about lighthouses, and they're all enthusiastic. They all build models used from recycling materials, a lighthouse that they've chosen to build and to study. One of our favorites, though, is Wind Point. It's the third tallest in Wisconsin at 108 feet, and there are lots of great stories about Wind Point. Early on, the keepers had a light that rotated. So the lens would rotate on an open bed of mercury, and there was machinery that was supposed to turn the lens. Well, Alfred B. Finch was the first keeper there when the light was first lit. The machinery did not work, and his logbook entries indicate he and his son stayed up, I believe it was 3 nights in a row, bitter cold temperatures, of course, in a metal tower, brick tower, turning the lens by hand so the signature flash would appear to mariners as if everything was working just fine.
Wow.
Allison, in regards to the Bailey's Harbor range lights in general were just this just marvelous invention by engineers. There were instances, Wisconsin has had three sets of range lights. Bailey's Harbor, 1869, is one of the oldest. Range lights are two structures, and when mariners are out on the lake coming into a port, there's certain harbors, if they're shallow, they're deep, they're rocky, there's hazards in the way. There's usually a straight path that they would follow, and the range lights, if you align the two when you're out on the water, vertically, completely straight vertically, you follow that path in, and that is the safe, correct course. Range lights today are one of the best restored in the state. The Ridges Sanctuary underwent a massive restoration of both of the range lights over the last several years. We're fortunate to know some of the people, mostly volunteers, that did a lot of the work. They can be toured seasonally. If you get to Door County, the range lights would be near the top of our list, along with Cana Island and Eagle Bluff.
Yeah. Allison, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Linda in Bayfield. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Larry. I'm Aaron's mom, remember?
Oh, yes. Hi, Linda.
Yes, okay. I'm calling from Bayfield because lighthouses are really important to us up here from the Apostle Islands, and people can get out on Raspberry Island, taken to them by the cruise line, and they can actually tour the settlement on Raspberry Island, and they have reenactors there. That will tell you about what their day is like and what is happening. And also Big Top Chautauqua does musicals and historical musicals, and their flagship musical is called Riding the Wind, and that is a lot about the lighthouse families, and they have wonderful historic pictures that they show, and they sing about it. So I would really encourage people, if they're interested in lighthouses and that kind of history, that they should come.
Oh, Linda,
and
yeah.
They do present that.
Linda, thank you so much for calling. Let's get some comments from Barb and Ken. Barb?
Oh, we love the Apostle Islands. We've been a number of times, and as Linda mentioned, you can take the cruise ships out to the light. Some of them are just drive-bys, but as Ken mentioned earlier, the lake is the boss. So if you're on a cruise ship and you're headed to Raspberry Island and the winds are not in your favor, you are not landing. You may see the keeper up at the top waving you goodbye. I'll miss you. But they do a wonderful job. We took in a day tour at Raspberry a number of years ago, and the ranger that was there and the reenactors were fantastic. And we can't say enough either about Big Top Chautauqua. It's amazing.
And if I'm not mistaken, Ken, the Raspberry Island Lighthouse, I think it was back in 2006, was restored?
It was, Larry. The National Park Service is in charge of the upkeep of all the lights in the Apostles area. The three main ones that they've done significant work on are number one, Raspberry. I believe it dates back to the era of around the 1920s. But they've also done significant work at Michigan Island. There's two lighthouses on Michigan Island in the Apostles. And then Sand Island is one of the lights a little bit further to the west. Cruise ships go by there, you know, spring through fall. As Barb mentioned, if the lake behaves, you can land. But around Labor Day, they have about a two-week celebration of the lighthouses in that area. And if the weather cooperates, you're able to land at a number of these lights, and the National Park Service has done wonderful restorations, some of the best that we've ever seen in the state. So please visit the Apostles. Wisconsin, we're fortunate to be able to visit a number of lights along the coastline, western coastline of Lake Michigan, Door County, and certainly Lake Superior with the Apostles.
It is really beautiful. In the PBS documentary that's on tonight, people are going to get a look at the really fine workmanship that was done inside that Raspberry Island Lighthouse. It's fantastic.
It sure is. It's beautiful. We encourage people to visit a lighthouse, and most of them are closed for the season now. But if you can't visit a lighthouse right now, you could join a lighthouse group and learn all about those lighthouses before you go visit in the spring.
Chris in Sturgeon Bay has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I'm going back to your comments about the Fresnel lenses. And when I toured Cape Cod Lighthouse, Cape Cod, Massachusetts, I learned that when they were changing out the Fresnel lenses for more modern lenses, that very often the workers would just throw the Fresnel lenses out the windows because they didn't feel like carrying them down. So we're lucky to be able to see those in museums and such. And then I have a question. Are there any Fresnel lenses still in use?
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you very much.
Great questions. Great questions, Chris. Unfortunately, Barb and I have heard some of those stories where really this priceless piece of engineering is destroyed or broken and thrown over the side. We hope there weren't too many of those actual instances. But today the Coast Guard wants to get out of the lighthouse business, the Fresnel lens business. Think back again when keepers were at lighthouses. Every single day that light got attention, it was cleaned, it was polished. Today, the Coast Guard is taking most of those out throughout the Great Lakes and throughout the country. Wisconsin is going to be privileged to have two lights, two Fresnel lenses, still stay in the towers. Barb mentioned Cana Island in Door County, and also Devil's Island in the Apostles has and will continue to have its Fresnel lenses. Many of the ones that are taken out today, fortunately, end up at historical societies and museums. And to be able to see these optics just a few feet away from you is marvelous.
Oh. Kim emailed to say their grandfather was an assistant lighthouse keeper at the Racine Breakwater and Port Washington in the 30s and 40s. And the pictures Kim has of him working are eye-opening, chopping ice with an axe to get into the offshore Racine Lighthouse must have been brutal. There's an article in a newspaper talking about him being stranded for several days until the weather cleared. Plus, they had to adhere to Coast Guard standards. Those people work very hard every day, and that can't be stressed enough.
They were very tough. They worked so very hard, and there are photos of lighthouse keepers arriving on station in the spring to find ice still covering the doors in the building, and they would have to chop their way in. And many stations, too, they would be manned for, say, a week, and then the next crew would come in. But if the weather was bad, you were not leaving the station, or perhaps the new crew was not getting out either. There were talk every so often in logbooks that they were running low on food, and they were hoping the weather would clear, but they just did their jobs.
Peter on the east side of Green Bay called, couldn't stay with us, but would like to hear more about how lighthouse keepers saved lives by rescuing crew members on ships that ran aground.
There are numerous stories, not just in Wisconsin, Larry, but throughout the Great Lakes and throughout the country and the world, of how important these folks were in addition to keeping the light. There's several examples both in Wisconsin and Lake Michigan of keepers seeing ships in distress. Some areas, in addition to a lighthouse, would also have had a life-saving station. Those gentlemen were primarily the ones that went out into the water in their small boats to try to rescue people. There was a keeper in Door County, Martin Knutson, who saved a number of people from two shipwrecks in the Death's Door Strait off of Pilot Island that wrecked the same evening. He got a commendation from the federal government for his bravery. But there's so many examples of most of the day-in and day-out chores. The logbooks would keep records of the temperature, the winds, the weather, ships passing. Every once in a while, you read the logbooks and you come across a nugget of something like this, a shipwreck, saving some folks out on the water. These folks were tremendously dedicated and hardworking people.
They were indeed. Do you have a favorite lighthouse?
Oh, boy. That's always a tough one. I would have to say it's the lighthouse I would be currently visiting at any given time. But then if you look at our books, obviously we've written some individual lighthouse books, and I love them all. I really cannot pick one unless I'm visiting, and that's my favorite one that day when I'm there.
That is a tough question, Larry. This lighthouse adventure that Barb and I are still on started at Cana Island in Door County, so that's certainly near the top of the list. And then when we learned of Georgia Stebbins in Milwaukee, a lady lighthouse keeper, a very rare occurrence back in that era, once we learned of her, Milwaukee North Point would be near the top as well.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with both of you today. I really appreciate the work you've done and appreciate you being with us today. Barb and Ken, thank you both so much for being with us. Barb and Ken Wardius, co-authors of Wisconsin Lighthouses, a Photographic and Historical Guide, and three other books about specific lighthouses in Door County, Racine, and Milwaukee. Great to have them with us. And don't forget tonight that PBS documentary titled Wisconsin Lighthouses. It premieres tonight at 7 p.m. And I know a lot of people are excited to see it. Thanks to Barb and Ken, and thanks to you for listening. And boy, you better stay with us, because our Wisconsin magazine, the latest edition, is now out, and we'll be talking about it with our old friend, Ken Beano. I'm Larry Mueller. If you feel lost and lonely and don't... Well, winter is upon us, and the first issue of the season for our Wisconsin magazine is with us as well. It includes a few stories about Christmas gifts and traditions and a whole lot more. Larry Mueller here, and here with us is our Wisconsin magazine editor, Mike Beno. The fall issue, the issue is out today. It's December and January issue. And we'll get a preview from Mike about it. And as usual, full of great photos, profiles of colorful Wisconsin characters, and some nostalgic memories. And I hope you'll join the conversation. What do you like about our Wisconsin magazine? Maybe you've got a story to tell that relates to something you've perhaps read about, or maybe you wish you'd be reading about in the magazine. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mike Beno, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry. It's always great to be back. Thanks for having me on. We've been doing this 12 years now. We just jumped into our 13th year. The magazine's rolling, and you were one of the very first people to believe in it. So thanks for that Christmas gift.
It's been fun talking with you over the years, Mike. There was some sad news to share in the current issue of our Wisconsin. And maybe talk about Roy Ryman. What an amazing guy.
Yeah, Larry, your background for so many years is agricultural journalism. I bet you a number of your students might have gone to work for Roy. Had you met him through the years, through his agricultural magazines at all?
A long time ago, I met him once, and you're right. Many of our students went to work in one or the other of his many publications.
Yeah, Rural Lifestyle magazines is where this old farm boy cut his teeth. He drove around the village of Greendale where he had his office with a little Honda that said Ag Mags on his license tags. But interesting story in American business, honestly. When you run into some of these entrepreneurs, there aren't all that many of them that have just crazy sparks flying off them, but that was this man. He grew up on a tenant farm in northwest Iowa. I mean, 12 kids in his graduating high school class. He had his father ran the farm using workhorses. He straddled the time between Belgian horses and tractors and mechanization that came to the farm in the 30s and 40s. When Roy died this past September, mid-September at age 90, he had a lot of stories to tell. He wound up, after going to school in at Iowa State, he always told the story. He didn't even know what a cheeseburger was when he went to Ames, Iowa. What's that, a grilled cheese sandwich? Well, he went into the advertising business, landed in Wisconsin, and he decided, you know, maybe he should go off on his own. Now, get this, his wife at the time and they had four kids. Fifth one on the way, and he had an idea for a magazine. Okay, well, why? Farm Journal in Chicago decided they were doing away with their women's section with recipes and things. So they couldn't sell enough advertising around that. And so he said, well, what'll my aunts read? What'll my mother read? A lot of people like those. Well, I could do a magazine. Well, wait a minute. If this big magazine isn't selling enough advertising, how could I have a prayer? And he's driving his Volkswagen around the rural countryside taking photos for agricultural advertising, combines, etc. And he had this thought: if somebody buys a book and they really like a book, what's in it? Well, they just pay the whole cost of the book. They don't expect 40% of it to be underwritten by advertising. If they like the book, they'll buy it. So if I give them a different magazine, something they like, why wouldn't they buy that? So what does he do? He's got all these little kids. He goes on his own, quits his job at the ad agency, takes a second mortgage on his house, and launches 300,000 copies of a magazine into the mail, shooting the dice, and there's no advertising in it.
Yeah.
People told him he was insane, okay? What he did with that magazine eventually became Country Woman magazine, and it led to him having 13 different magazines with 16 million circulation across the United States. To put that into perspective, Time at its height had 4.2 million circulation. The cooking magazine Roy came up with, Taste of Home, had 5.3 million circulation. And people kept telling him, no, you can't do magazines without advertising. Well, he did. One in every eight homes in the United States carried one of his titles in the 1990s. So it was my privilege to go to work for this madman with, like I said, sparks flying off him. He never sat still. And he co-founded Our Wisconsin with me 13 years ago, and as he always did, he would jump into something for a year, get it up and going, then he would trundle off on his way to the next big thing, you know, like a dog chasing a blowing box down the road. And that was him. And I'll just say this. The man died with his boots on because the last business day before he just didn't wake up, he emailed us a note about some big idea that just couldn't miss, and the next day he was gone. So pulling levers right up to the end. And we're fortunate to have met him, and a lot of memories go with a character like that.
Yeah, it, what a wonderful concept, and obviously he was right. And if you supply something that interests people and strongly interests them, they're willing to pay the full freight, even though the cost, like Our Wisconsin, the cost is not that great, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, thank you. $24.98 for six issues per year, and we try to do things backwards, which was Roy's way. While most of the print publications have been forced to go to very cheap paper, smaller sizes, we try to take it the opposite way. We get the best glossy paper we can find. We put a lot into the printing and color, with the thought that people will pick it up and find some heft and some perceived value. It's something worth spending their time with. It's more entertainment reading than it is straight information. The web is full of straight information. It's abundant. This is for when you want to put your feet up and read by the fire and a little entertainment. It's a lot of stories about people, and I'm a firm believer that people like to read about people most of all, doing unusual things.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. You know, and the December-January issue has lots of great stories as usual, including some sentimental Christmas memories that I liked a lot. Maybe you can talk about the little stuffed dog.
Yeah. Now, this is another hallmark of the old Ryman magazine models. You go straight to the readers themselves and ask them to share stories. Could be about anything. The idea is that it's not just professional journalists talking down to people. It's neighbors. It's neighborly stuff. And we do that, and once in a while, stories will come in that really, really touch you. Christmas, of course, is the time when there's a lot of nostalgia and some sweet stories. A little bit of that is always good. So, Little Dog That Saved Christmas. We heard from one reader, Susan Cordula from Three Lakes, and she's sharing a story from Christmas of '62 when she was traveling from Black River Falls to her grandparents' home, with her parents, to her grandparents' home to celebrate Christmas. Well, along the way, they get the news that there has been a fire at Grandma and Grandpa's home. Everybody was okay. The house was still standing, but there was some serious damage there. And anybody who's ever had to clean up after a fire and the scrubbing and all that sort of stuff will understand what a big job this is in the wintertime. It wasn't any fun. The tree had caught fire. So they decided, well, we're going to make the most of this. And they went there to Grandma and Grandpa's house and dove in, started scrubbing, hauled the tree out, start pulling the wooden floor up and going to replace that. Grandpa's on the phone with the insurance agents, and everybody else is scrubbing and hauling and dragging things out to the front yard in the snow, cleaning up after the firefighters who saved their house. And while they're out there, they found the smashed tree and ornaments and things out in the yard, and something caught Susan's eye. It was a little speck of red in the snow, and Susan and her mother. And mother went out and recognized this small little stuffed dog was laying amid the burnt tree, the branches and the tinsel and the smashed ornaments. And this little dog ornament had survived the fire somehow. It was a little scorched, a little beat up, but Susan's mother understood the value of this to her mother, and she took that dog, and while everybody's cleaning up the house and living on ham sandwiches and got scrub buckets, she takes a little toothbrush, she starts touching up this dog, cleaning him up, and he's missing a leg, maybe I can repair this, repair that. Finally, after two or three days' worth, they got the house back to habitable condition. And Dad found a Charlie Brown tree out on the leftover on the lot, bought a couple of Christmas boxes and Christmas ornaments on clearance, and they set up a tree. But this little dog was the last remnant of all their family's Christmas things. This dog was hung there amid all the cheap ornaments that were going out the door on sale. And ever since, this dog hasn't been put away with the Christmas stuff. It has been on Grandma's dressing table. She's 99 and still has that little dog there, reminding them of the Christmas of 62. When they didn't have much, they had ham sandwiches, they had a bunch of a mess. That's the Christmas they remember the most, and this little dog symbolizes it.
Yeah, it's a, and you know, I read a story, it might have been in the Washington Post, about how there's a return to the old ornaments, and not the fancy glitzy stuff that you can buy, that a lot of people are going back to the traditional ornaments for their Christmas trees. And this kind of fits in a little bit with that. I think there's maybe a wanting to return to nostalgia kind of thing.
That's loaded with memories. You know, as I said, Christmas is the stories that come back about Christmas are so deeply imbued in our memories. And what you're talking about, Larry, I am 100% for. Sometimes isn't simpler, sometimes better.
Yeah, yeah, yes, it is. My tree, I just put, my daughter Emily and I just put our tree up this last weekend, and all of the ornaments have been around a long time. But the favorite ones are the ones that Emily or Carolee or Diane, the daughters, made over the years. And those are the ones that get the prominent display, along with one or two from past girlfriends that I got for Christmas, ornaments I got for Christmas from them.
Did your family ever hide a pickle on the tree?
No.
No. Your family heritage is Scandinavian?
French and English.
French and English, okay. You know Norwegian,
yes.
Words.
Oh,
I know,
yes.
That for sure. French and English. Many of Polish extraction, one of the traditions is to hide a pickle, a pickle ornament somewhere on that tree, and the child who finds it, the parents hide it, the child who finds it wins some kind of a prize. So.
Well, I've got a little fake squirrel hiding in the tree. So
good for you. As long as it's not a live one.
No. Mike Beto, our guest today. We're having some fun talking with him. He is editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine. Maybe you've got a question or a comment about the magazine or maybe a story to share. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. And a reminder, if you missed part of our show or you want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of our broadcasts going back, I'm pretty sure, at least 13 years to when Ken Beto started with me. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. Questions or comments for our guest today, Mike Beto of Our Wisconsin Magazine. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Comment about the magazine or maybe a story to share during this season. Love to hear from you. Jeff Robbins, our technical director, says his wife's family is German, and they do the pickle thing every year. He thought it originated from Germany.
Maybe it did.
Might have. Who knows? Oh, my gosh. And Jill Nadeau says, I did, too. So there you go. There's a couple more pickles. And they're pickles. The recipes in the book, it's always, baking in the holiday season. I just posted on my own Facebook page a shot from 4 years ago, I think it was, or no, 7 years ago, of my daughter Emily with Grandma Ione, and they were baking Christmas cookies. And I put that up just the other day. And one of your field editors shares some of her stories and recipes. How important are recipes to readers?
Oh my, well, everybody eats. I think that might have been one reason why A Taste of Home magazine jumped to 5.3 million. But yeah, you can't go wrong when you have good recipes, and they're tried and true ones, and they're tested, and all of that. Our field editor, Kate Bender, from Columbia County, she not only shared some recipes, principally her grandmother's sugar cookies, Nani's sugar cookies, which is the recipe we've got in there is a basic sugar cookie. Of course, they're famous because they're so easily decorated.
Yeah.
They come out nice and flat. But what she also shared was, and I wish we had a little video going on this, those are her daughters that are making cookies. Mm. She shared pictures of her daughters, and they're about 3 and 5 years old, rolling out cookies and making a mess in the kitchen and having a blast. And that's part of it too. Not only the good stuff that comes out of it that we can't help eating, but the memories of getting together and doing this around the table, getting flour all over the place, fighting over who gets to put this color on and that color on, but it always winds up great, and other memories of Christmas. So we've got three cookie recipes in here with the stories behind them and the little girls enjoying them. But also at the tail end of the magazine, we've got, we always share 12 recipes every time. And that is one of the highlights of the magazine when we listen to the readers. In fact, we've just upped the number of recipes in that section from 8 to a dozen, 13, if you count the lead cook we're showing. So, yeah, people, you can't miss with recipes.
Well, I'm a fan of Butterballs, and I've never made them, and I see that your field editor has a recipe for them, so I'm going to try that out. I love those butterballs.
There
you know,
we go.
And you know what? You had another story about the cranberry pie guy, which I really enjoyed a lot. And what's the story behind that recipe is a fun one.
It is. That I'm Larry, I'm glad you agree with me. That's one of my favorite stories in the issue. It came to us from a reader, Marv Kolbeck, in Pittsville. Now, Pittsville is dead set in the center of the state in the Wisconsin Rapids area, which is cranberry country, as we know. Marv was a farm boy who grew up in Manitowoc County on a dairy farm, and he went away to school, and he learned enough to become an agricultural agent working with the state, and that group of people aids the citizens by education, teaching many different aspects of, well, in his case, agriculture, but many, many different disciplines. Marv wrote to us. Marv's now 93. He moved to Pittsville, and he had to learn the difference between dairying and growing cranberries in a quick hurry, okay? He had to learn about not only growing cranberries, in which Wisconsin leads the nation in perennially, probably 60% of the crop in the United States is grown here. He had to learn about that, but the unique culture as well. And he had something to do with forming the curriculum of cranberry science, cranberry growing science, in the high school there in that area. So he's been up to his armpits in Wisconsin's top fruit crop for a long time. But in the beginning, he had a lot to learn. And he said, "Want to hear the story about me baking a pie on television when I never baked a pie in my life? I got a picture of me in a foofy hat." I knew what he meant. Chef's hat. So the story was, young man moves to Pittsville, and he's pushing cranberries a little bit, helping promote the fruit crop in the center of the state, cranberry production, and also share his agricultural knowledge. Well, Wood County Home Economics Agent Loretta Zastro was one of his colleagues, and she said, "You know, Marv, you should push cranberries next time you're on TV." Well, okay. In the 1950s and 60s, noon shows were big on the television, local TV markets around the state. They'd have, little news, little weather, some live entertainment, and they would have in a little education, and they would call in these state agents to do a little spiel about some subject to teach. And so Orville Buck Leverton hosted a popular noon show on WSAU in Wausau. Loretta Zastro says to Marv, "Why don't you bake a pie on TV, cranberry walnut pie?" And they'd mix that in between the live entertainment with, you know, polka acts like the Arnie Kurth Trio or Big John Schofield, and they'd work in Marv baking a pie. Well, he wasn't going to do it, but the staff worked on him hard enough until he said, "All right, I'll do it." So he's getting ready to go into the studio early, and this was all on live TV. And what amazed me was he brought along a camp stove with fuel, and he cooked it on that in the TV station. I mean, with curtains and stuff around. This was the beginning of television here. It's like 1961. So he's packing up his boxes at his courthouse office, and he's nervous, and he's got two boxes of his stuff, all his ingredients, his camp stove, his fuel, name it. He loads it in the vehicle, and he's driving, and he's not even out of town yet, crossing the river, and an oncoming driver is waving frantically at him, and what's going on? He stops. he left a box on top of his props on top of his car, and it was still riding along with him on the roof. All right, so he nervously chucks that in the back seat, and he heads on up to Wausau, and he gets there in good time, brings in his boxes and starts setting up his table on the set. He's going to go live. One box is loaded with whipped cream because he jarred an aerosol can and it discharged all its contents inside the box. So he's got to clean up all this junk. And still, he's as if he's not nervous enough. So he gets up there and gets it all cleaned up, and he's standing there with the white hot lights on him. Go! he starts working on it, and he pulled it off without a hitch. But he learned a lesson there, this greenhorn baker. He pulled it off, and he made his pie on set. I'm sure his shirt was all pitted out with the nerves underneath all those lights and stuff. And he said he's very proud to this day at age 93. I received 96 phone calls and letter requests for that recipe, cranberry walnut pie. And he's convinced it had nothing to do with the pie. He's convinced that he stood up there and fessed up to all his blunders that he did, tripping his way into the studio. And the people liked that better than they liked the pie and the recipe, because this guy would have the guts to get up there and make his pie for the first time and would share all his blunders. So anyway, we shared the cranberry walnut pie, but I got to tell you, he helped me out. I needed a picture of the cranberry walnut pie. He says, Mike, okay, I got you a picture. And Marv, he says, Bucks and Berries Cafe in Babcock. Mandy Norton is the proprietor. She bakes and sells about 50 of these things a week. They're great, but she'll take a picture for you, I bet. And she was quite busy during the Cranberry Festival up there. You know, Warren's and everybody gets going. Had a lot of business. But Mandy Norton shot a photo of this pie, and she's got it there. So if you want to have some of that with ice cream, stop in at Bucks and Berries. One other thing about Marv. He said, so they're highlighting this pie as part of their Splash of Red Cranberry Fest near Pittsville every year. And he's happy that he still makes it, and he's proud to report it's good enough for he and his wife to consume a whole pie in less than a week.
Well, and we have the recipe for it, and there's another one. I got a pound of frozen cranberries in my freezer, and I'm thinking to try that cranberry walnut pie.
Give it a shot. It's been around forever, and it's stood the test of time, like we said before, home tested.
Oh, man. Well, we've been talking a lot about food. Let's turn to animals for a minute. And once in a while, not often, but once in a while, you republish a story. And in this issue, Tom Davis has a dandy full of great information about porcupines.
And what do they call a young porky?
Quill pig?
Yeah, that's right. Quilted. There we go. They are called porcupets, and we did not make that up. Tom Davis, the longtime outdoor writer, he was with Wisconsin Trails magazine 14 years back in the day, but he's most well known nationally for working on hunting outdoors magazines, especially the higher end ones with the English Setters and the Tweedy jackets and the fine double guns, all of which I go hunting. But if I went in the field wearing something nice with a real nice gun, people would laugh at me because I couldn't hit myself in the butt with a handful of rock salt. Tom is well imbued with this knowledge. And in the beginning, we brought him aboard because he is well known from Wisconsin Trails, but again, also nationally, years ago I worked at Ducks Unlimited's magazine and got to know him. So he did a 13 years in, he's done a few articles that have been very well received, And every once in a while, we'll dust one of those off. It's an evergreen, and rerun it, because our circulation these days is far beyond what it was. It was a fraction of its number in the beginning, and a lot of people miss some of this. So he's talking about quill pigs. The slow moving animal everybody, most people seem to dislike. Those are dog owners, but I think those who don't have dogs kind of admire these plucky guys. I live in the far north woods of Presque Isle, and we work out of Manitowish waters. There's a little bit of half log siding on the house, and I couldn't figure out before I moved here full time what's chewing on my house. Well, it's got to be something that can climb. It was deep brown stain on some of this exterior, and I've seen chew marks all over the house. What is this? And so I'd swipe a little stain over it, and I'd come back, and there's more. What's going on? Is this squirrel? Well, finally, happened to be up there one time, and I hear from someone in another room, there's a porcupine chewing on the house. And that was true. And there had to be something in that stain that was attracting this arboreal critter, lives in trees. They're known for their need for salt. They will, if you leave s'mores outside, an axe outside, something like that, when you shouldn't, they'll sure love to gnaw on the handle and find some salt from your use of it. They like T111 siding, some of the glue and plywood they will like to chew. So they're an interesting adaptive critter. They walk maybe 2 miles an hour. They can. Too bad we see too many of them as roadkill, but they seem to be pretty prolific. They're around. They're loaded with quills, 30,000 quills. They're born with quills, and the quills is as big a mess as they make in dogs. They have antibiotic properties that you're not likely to get an infection if you get a porky quill stuck in you. No way to get it, way to remove them is to pull them straight out. Maybe sometimes you clip it in the middle and let the air out of it. It's really a big stiff hair with some barbs on the end. Interesting animal. They only have one predator of any note. That's a fisher, and they're in the state of Wisconsin as well. But this is an example of some natural history that a very literary writer like Tom Davis can spin in a way that makes it interesting all the way through. It isn't dry.
It is not dry at all. And it reminded me, I thought back to a friend of mine, Mike Korfmacher, rest his soul, who built a tree stand out of plywood for deer hunting and left it out in the woods. And he came back quite a while later, and the whole tree stand was gone, most except for the little parts around the where he had bolts, and the porcupine couldn't quite get to every last bit of it, but it was gone.
Yeah, they will. You use plywood to build your hunting tree house, they will gnaw great big holes in it. When you come back to it toward the end of summer to take a look and make sure it's safe, you got some extra work. Who is around.
Mike Beno, editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine, having some fun talking with him today about the December-January issue of the magazine. He comes by pretty much every time a new issue comes out, and it's always great to have him come by and talk about Our Wisconsin Magazine. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Mike Beno, editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine. It's great to have him with us today to visit about the magazine itself and tell some stories about what has occurred in the magazine. It's always a lot of fun for me, and I'm pretty sure it's fun for you. Join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Just a quick reminder, tomorrow we'll be talking about books for adults and children to give as gifts for the holiday season. Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, will be with us. And then Tessa Schmidt and Megan Schliesman at the UW-Madison's Cooperative Children's Book Center will be along to talk about children's books as well. So looking forward to that tomorrow. Right now, give a call with your questions or comments, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Mike, every year you have a treasure hunt, which I love, and this year's prize is a doozy. Talk about it and how folks can participate.
Okay, well, if anybody out there has interest in winning a prize package of two e-bikes in a carrier worth $5,700 in value, and you like to get out and walk around and see Wisconsin and then maybe also pedal and ride around Wisconsin, we've got something for you. So, Larry, thanks for bringing this up. We a feature of the magazine, and you talked before about Roy Ryman. We try to blend different things into this magazine to make it unique. Different from the others. So one of the features, going back to the beginnings of the magazine, is our treasure hunt. And what we do is we offer an attractive prize like I just talked about here. We've given away a couple of cars, a couple of boat, motor, and trailer packages. We've given away teardrop camping trailers, custom trailers. And to earn that, all you have to do is find the key we've hidden somewhere in a park in Wisconsin. The idea is that we hide it in a public park, no trespassing by sending people out there to take a look for it. We put it in a plastic bag, biodegradable, along with a note saying, "You've won. You've won this prize. This is no joke. Here is the phone number you should call. We're going to give you a code number to recite, and you've just won this prize," which is some of the stuff I talked about. And what we do then is the page in the magazine, we put in a map of Wisconsin, it's all 72 counties, and issue by issue, we eliminate 10 of them to narrow the search area. We also give a clue, okay, telling people where to look, how they might find it. And issue by issue, the mystery kind of unfolds here because we give a new clue every issue, and we repeat them so you can jump in at any time. And the search area gets narrower and narrower. Last time, we got it down to two counties before somebody finally found the thing in where I had hidden it in Juneau County. We were down to two, and a couple from next door when they heard it was down to two counties, decided to get out and look. And they pulled up to a park. It was wintertime. It was closed, and there were about eight cars pulled up around the on the county trunk, and they heard people coming out. A lot of hunters in there. So people participate in this, okay? So the idea came to us, why not his and hers e-bikes? Okay, that's a good idea because we see it every day up here in Manitowish Waters. We've got 60 miles of paved bike trails you can ride between Mercer and St. Germain, and there's bike trails all over the state, Elroy, Sparta, and there's more as the months go by. E-bikes, the thing about them is, yes, they've got a battery in them, yet they can give you a little boost on the hills. These have changed the culture of bike riding, and I see it out here continually. These are not for the super bikers who go 40 and 50 miles road biking every day. I have friends who do that. They're athletes, and they're into it, and they're great. What I'm seeing, though, as I'm riding, I'm the old guy now. I'm riding my regular bike, and I'm hearing behind me people saying, on your left, and here come people, couples. They're all a little older than me, and they're coming by, and they all have grins on their faces. Well, why? They could get back into biking again. Maybe their knees can't take it so much anymore. Maybe they're not quite as nimble as they had been in the past. Maybe they need a little help on the hills. They're back on the trails, and they're loving it. So these bikes that were given away are made in Hingham, Wisconsin, at a company called Small Town Bike Company. Fitting. It's in the northern Kettle Moraine, Sheboygan County. And the owner of the company is an electrical engineer who re-engineered these, gave it a big, fat battery that'll carry 50 miles. They can get up to nearly 20 miles an hour. And you can win a pair of these. They're retro. They're cruiser models. You can step through the frame. You don't have to throw a leg over the top. So next issue, February, March, we're going to give the first clue and eliminate the first 10 counties. So if you want to get in the hunt for these bikes, get ready. Keep your eyes open on the next issue, and here we go.
Lots of fun. Jeff in Superior has something for you for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, gentlemen. Happy holidays. And I'm calling today to celebrate Martin Pattison. You know, he had the Fairlawn Mansion built here in Superior. And the holidays are a special time up here in the city of Superior because of Fairlawn having weekly Christmas parties, gatherings open to the public. I was wondering if the magazine is interested in stepping back in history and telling the story of Martin Pattison.
And are we talking Pattison State Park?
That as well. Martin Pattison passed away in 1918. The park began in 1920, so it celebrated 100-year centennial, a couple of years ago. And they're currently undergoing some renovations at Pattison Park to update some of the infrastructure, things like that.
But a story about Martin Pattison, Mike.
Would love to do that. I've heard the name, and I believe he make his fortune in lumber. I'm thinking, and there is more, I think, even than that park that's credited to him in that area up around Douglas County. Good idea, Jeff. What I always say is, if somebody has an idea and they want to give it a shot to start us out by writing a letter to us. You don't have to write a finished story. Just send us a tip, if you will, in letter form. It could be email, could be letter. And let us know a little bit about the basics of it. This is a straight history story, but I think it's something that is pretty monumental when you look at the good that was done here. And then some ideas on photos. And that's generally how these stories begin. I mentioned before Marv in the Cranberry Guy. He just had a photo and an idea and a letter. And so, Jeff, I thank you for that tip. I think that'd make a very worthy story.
And Jeff, thank you for calling. As a matter of fact, we've got somebody on who has submitted a story, Joni in Manitowoc. Hi, Joni.
Hi. Yeah, I submitted a story about the USS or the SS Badger and the engineer who takes care of the engine room. You don't think about those guys running the boat. So, I mean, we had a really cool picture of him inside one of the ginormous pistons. But what made me think of calling in was all of a sudden in my mailbox, I get this gorgeous pecan pie from the Yoders just for writing a story for our Wisconsin magazine. I was tickled pink to be told that I was published, but then, you know, the icing on the cake was getting that pie in the mail. Do they still do that?
Oh, yes. Thanks for that, Joni.
And that was a good story, by the way, Joni. I remember that story.
Yeah, she had... That's really what caught my interest. I mean, I've ridden the Badger across from Ludington one time, been on the boat, seen it forever. It's got a national historic registration tied to it. It's still hauling cars back and forth. But she shared a photo of one of the technicians, the maintenance guy, crawling through the guts of an engine while they're rebuilding this thing. It looks like he's in a cave in West Virginia. He's crawling the inside of the engine. And, yeah, everybody thinks about standing at the rail and taking in the views and getting something from the concessions counter, and isn't this relaxing? Well, what does it take to keep that thing going? So that's the kind of different story we're looking for. And, Joni, I'm glad that you enjoyed being published. I hope you heard from a number of friends. Often we hear people say, I've heard from friends I've not heard from in decades that have gotten back in touch with me once they ran into this story. So what Joni's talking about with the pies is we have an Amish diarist in Owen Yoder, in dairy farmer in Cecil, Wisconsin, who from the beginning has shared a week's worth of his and his family's life on the farm daily. What are they doing on the farm? Milking a lot of cows, but which can get pretty repetitive, but what else in their day? And he shares a week-long diary, and people love that story. They've connected with this family. Unfortunately, a couple of years ago, Owen's wife, Treva, died. He's got about 45 grandkids. He's got a big family around him. But Owen received hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces of mail, literally, just cards to him about this. Owen and his family baked pecan pies for us, okay? And they have a family bakery up there, and Owen, on the weekends in summer principally, the bakery is open. So Owen bakes pies for us. We, in this December-January issue, we set a record with 66 pies being shipped to, he bakes them in a stove right there. He does it, this old Amishman. We sent out to the contributors our Wisconsin magazine. Now, we do pay freelance writing or photography fees for something that covers a page or two or more in the issue. We're not that cheap. We do pay something. But for smaller stories, things a few paragraphs in length, we ship a pecan pie. Why pecan? They ship the best. It's much
They're really good, too.
Better than a lemon. Okay, Larry, you've had one, huh?
Yes, I have, and they're very good.
Okay, and Owen packs them up securely. We've never had a problem with a smashed one. In fact, we've sent them to Hawaii and Germany, and they've made it. But people, well, we've opened up and sent pies to some of the longer story people because what we've heard from some people is that, hey, thank you for this check. Sure, you know, that's great. Grocery money always helps. It's always good to get a check. But what I really wanted was that pie. So, you know, sometimes you can't win. So he thought, okay, let's cut down the price, the check a little bit, and then they'll get some money, but then they'll get a pie afterwards, so they're happy twice.
And on that happy note, we are out of time. Oh, Mike, it's always a pleasure. OurWisconsin.com, you can take a look there if you need to get yourself a subscription. But in the meantime, I want to thank Mike so much, and I want to thank you for listening in today, and of course, thank all of our people who work for the show, Clara Neiper, Joel Padnott, our producers, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producers Jill Nadeau, and I'm Larry Mueller. Lots of fun here on WPR News, and you stay with us. Lots more in store.